morning. The time is 9:06. Beautiful start weather-wise here in central Wisconsin. At our studios on East Wausau Avenue, 63 degrees under fair skies. I'm Chad Holmes. It is our number two of the Chad Holmes Show on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230. Online at bowfallsradio.com, mobile devices, and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. It looks like it is going to be a gorgeous day to do almost anything throughout central Wisconsin today. And to find out about the forecast for today and into the middle portion of the work week, we're joined from Weatherology by our meteorologist, Jennifer Vuchiski. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, yesterday was a bit different. It was pretty dark. It was overcast. We had plenty of rain. It was chilly. We never got outside the low 60s yesterday, but already temperature into the low to mid 60s already. A lot of sunshine. It looks like going to be a tale of 2 days, a beauty today after a very, I thought, overcast and kind of dreary day yesterday.
It was, yeah, exactly. So a little bit of a different day overall today, as you mentioned. So we're looking at sunny skies, highs getting up right around about the upper 70s. It's actually pretty average for this time of the year. We should be right around about 80 degrees. Tonight we'll have partly cloudy skies, overnight lows around about 57. It's a little warmer here for your day on Wednesday as a brief warm front pushes through. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow, high around about 83 degrees. We do have a pretty decent chance for some showers and storms, though, coming in by Wednesday night. And then on Thursday, we'll have a drop in temperatures, actually, by nearly 10 degrees as a quick cold front comes in. Mostly sunny skies for Thursday, high around 74. Slightly warmer on Friday, mostly sunny, high gets up around about 79 degrees. But a significant increase in temperatures here for the weekend ahead. Saturday, we'll see sunny skies and a 10-degree increase as that warm front pushes through, high around about 89.
Yeah, you said it. I mean, not only Saturday, but even looking beyond that, I mean, we're going to probably see some of the hottest temperatures we've seen all summer long by the time we get to the end of the weekend and maybe even to early next week, aren't we?
Yeah, by Sunday, it looks like we'll get into the mid-90s, so that'll be definitely, summer's not quite done yet.
No, it's definitely not. Thanks again for the information, Jennifer. Have yourself a great Tuesday, and we'll catch you again tomorrow.
Thanks so much. You too.
That is our meteorologist, Jennifer Vuchiski from weatherology.com here on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230. Right now, the temperature stands at 63 degrees under fair skies. Again, it doesn't really get much better than this in terms of starting off a morning. When I got up, came here to work, it was in the low 50s, and just it felt so comfortable. And that's one of the great things. And of course, as we talk about going into the mid-90s by next week, you savor those moments of coolness. But right now, 63 under sunny skies, no winds. The dew point is 53 degrees, relative humidity of 70%, the barometer at 30.07 inches, and a visibility of 10 miles. And as we've heard about, it's going to be really warm on the weekend. Fortunately, the real heat wave doesn't begin until Saturday, because Friday night, when we have our first high school football broadcast of the season, the temperatures, both Thursday and Friday, we have games on Thursday for some teams and many games on Friday. Thursday's high in the mid-70s, and then the upper 70s to around 80 on Friday. So should be very comfortable. And a big thing as well, Friday night, no signs of any thunderstorms, because early in the season, from time to time, we seem to have those issues with thunderstorms. I don't know how many times over the last number of years where I'll be doing a game on a Friday night, all of a sudden the clouds will roll in, and then all of a sudden thunderstorms. And there's a rule for the WIAA. If you see any lightning, you have to stop immediately, clear out basically the stadium, and then a 30-minute clock goes up, and you have to have 30 minutes without any lightning. So if you have, 25 minutes, no lightning, then all of a sudden another one bolt of lightning pops up, you have to reset the clock and start all over again. So every week I look ahead to see whether or not there's going to be any chance of some thunderstorms on a Friday night. And fortunately, no chance. It's going to be clear skies Friday night, low around 60 after a high near 80 with sunny skies on Friday. It will be a little warm for the Newman Cardinals on Saturday. The eight-player champions, they have their scrimmage Saturday afternoon. Saturday, sunny and 89, so it's going to be a pretty big test for those Cardinals during their scrimmage on Saturday, and starts a Saturday morning. And if you're looking for some fun, head on over to Newman Catholic's football field for that scrimmage on Saturday. The time is 9:11. Coming up, we're going to have our second guest for this morning. We'll be talking to Ken Farmer. Again, we had Ken on about a month or so ago talking about his memoir, a really interesting book titled Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. We talked about the story of his family, including his brother Lee, who suffered from schizophrenia. We didn't really go into the law that much. And Ken Farmer is a lawyer based in Stevens Point. And we're going to talk about the law. Talk about what the law was when he and his family were dealing with it in the 1970s, how things have changed, and maybe things that can be even improved as we move into the future. So Kenneth Farmer, author of Lee, coming up next as we continue on this Tuesday morning. I'm Chad Holmes. It is the Chad Holmes Show on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230, bowfallsradio.com, mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Show on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230, online at bowfallsradio.com, mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Looking ahead to tomorrow, in the first hour, we'll be joined by Bob Look for our bi-weekly visit, talk about the news going on around the state of Wisconsin, talk a little sports as well. And then at 9:15 tomorrow morning, we'll be joined by Sean Wright from the Grand Theater in Wausau for their bi-weekly talk about what's going on at the Grand. And Ken Farmer has joined us here in studio to sit on right by the microphone. Ken, walking in at the perfect time. Good to see you again, number one.
Oh, nice seeing you.
We had you on, I don't know, I lose all sense of timing these days, I tell you. I have no idea, but I think it's a little more than a month ago, came on to talk about your memoir titled Lee, the tragic story of a family broken by schizophrenia. And during our conversation, we talked about the book, and I said it, I just found it a really interesting and an entertaining read as well. I thought it was a real page-turner, really enjoyed reading it. But we talked about your story, your family story, and we didn't get a whole lot into the law. And you, as a practicing attorney, being involved in numerous situations during the course of your life in terms of working, you know, with the issues with your brother, we never really had a chance to talk about the law. And it's a very interesting because things have changed since the mid-1970s when you first were in a situation where you needed to institutionalize your brother, I guess, for lack of a better term, up until where we are today, maybe where we're going in the future. But why don't we start back in the 1970s in terms of what you had to deal with the law? Where were we as a society when it came to dealing with schizophrenia and also with the families who may be in a dangerous situation? I think as we talked to you the first time around, there were some very dangerous times with your brother. What was the law like back in the 1970s?
Well, the Wisconsin statutes have had quite a bit of evolution over time. In 1971, there was a series of statutes passed, and basically you had to have three adults, which is the same thing as today, mm-hmm. saying the person was mentally ill. But the criteria didn't even include dangerousness at that time. It just said whether the person was mentally ill and whether they were a proper subject for treatment. Two physicians were appointed to examine the individual. There wasn't any notice of jury trial. There was a right to a jury trial, but if you didn't know you had that right, I guess it usually was before the judge. And there was no preliminary hearing or anything. And then what happened was there was a court case out of Milwaukee, a class action suit called Lessard versus Schmidt. And what happened in that case is a woman was committed without a jury trial, without a lawyer. He didn't even have a right to a lawyer then. Mm. And she spent time inpatient for over 140 days with little more than a paperwork review by the judge. And so that lawsuit overturned the law in Wisconsin. And with that decision and the 1975 Mental Health Act, you had a right to a jury trial. You had a right to a public defender. You had a right to have notice of your jury trial. The criteria changed, so an individual had to be dangerous to themselves or others and not just mentally ill.
It's a mad, you know, when you talk about it, you have to look at it from both the individual and the family and society. I mean, there really are different people that need to be protected within this, and that makes it probably very complicated as well, because you need to protect the individual as well. I mean, even, you know, you feel like we were talking about what you and your family, and it almost felt like, you know, automatically what you would need to do, but at the same time, situations are different. We have to be looking after the person that has the illness, the family and society as a whole. That makes it a lot of levels, doesn't it?
Right, right. And having been on both sides of that as a lawyer, I understand that. There does definitely have to be a balance between the two. And unfortunately, before 1975, the balance was in favor of committing an individual with very few rights.
Right.
But then they went the other way, and maybe they went a little too far with the rights thing. And but many of those provisions are still in effect today. And you know, there have been changes since then. The criteria, for example, for commitment have been broadened over time. Mm-hmm. Before it was just dangerous to yourself or others. That was in 75, okay, mm-hmm. with the new Mental Health Act. And then they adopted other criteria, like a basic needs test. If a person was, because of mental illness, they weren't able to provide for the basic needs of shelter and food and things like that. They adopted what are called an impairment test, a grave impairment type test, where an individual is so mentally ill that they just couldn't protect themselves. They would walk out in the middle of traffic, for example. It's not really, you know, but the major criteria has remained, which is that you either be dangerous to yourself or others. And if you're dangerous to others, you really, unless you commit a homicidal act, you have to show that the individual was committed an overt act or threat, a recent one, of violence. And that's where our family ran into trouble.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you to take what you've learned as a lawyer and all the experiences you've had as a lawyer since then, and maybe put yourself back in your mind back in those days in the 70s when you first were realizing, hey, we need to take that next step. And as the book talks about, that was not easy because your mother was so against taking that step. But based on what you know now and what your mental state was, and knowing what your brother was, you know, what you were seeing with your brother back then, how difficult was it for somebody in your shoes back then? Because you now know, I think, a lot more. Did you feel like you and your family and others were treated in the right way? Do you feel like, man, this was a lot harder than it should have been? How do you know, based on your life experience and putting yourself back there, how do you look back at that in terms of what you had to go through?
Well, I think the system was going through changes, so I can't completely fault the system. because they didn't know what to do. These changes that were in effect weren't technically legal at that point, but they went with them because they thought that's what the law would be. So, but they didn't know if to go with the old law or the new law. So they were kind of confused too at that point. So I can't completely blame them, but it just seemed as if there wasn't a prosecutor on the case initially to give our family advice. I don't know if that was the fault of the judge. The judge had some discretion then as to have whether to have a prosecutor on it. Mm-hmm. I felt like the social workers, they tried to explain to us the law, but when I'd ask them to call me back, they weren't as communicative perhaps as they should have been with me and my family. And so that now that has changed a lot. I think there's a lot more information being given to families, and the law is a lot clearer than it was before. But it was difficult at the time. It was very scary because I had no legal training then right. or anything. I was relying upon my brother's public defender to tell me the law, even though he's on the other side.
Right.
You know, so it was a difficult problem.
And how old were you again?
I was 19.
Exactly. We were talking about the first time around.
Right.
19 years old. You're trying to start college, and all of a sudden you made the decision. Basically, you did. Right.
I was the one that initiated these things. Now my father went along with it, but I was the one that got the information and pushed it. And it was difficult for me because my brother was definitely a mentor to me earlier. And so that was difficult.
Again, we're talking to Ken Farmer, author, attorney, author of Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. And again, you can go back onto our podcast page. We talked a lot with Ken over an hour's time about a month ago. And I will put on our social media again the date of it. I'll dig that out as I try to put together all these dates in my head. But you can listen back to a lot of interesting stories from this book. And today we're trying to delve a little bit into the law aspect. As again, for folks, we'd say you're a lawyer. What is your specialty, has been over the years, your specialty in the law when you were working?
Criminal law. I was a public defender. But then when I first became a public defender, they had me do juvenile, then they had me do about a year in mental health. They called it the mental health unit, not the mental illness unit.
Right.
And so I had to defend people who were facing commitment like my brother, but it was in Kentucky where the law was a lot different than here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other experience I had is when I became a prosecutor. I came back to Wisconsin after being a public defender for 5 years and worked in Manitowoc. And honestly, I didn't have a problem personally dealing with these cases in Kentucky because the law was different. It was 500 miles away, my experience, mm-hmm. too, and so I could divorce myself. But I found when I had to do commitment cases as a prosecutor in Manitowoc that was very difficult for me because it was the same basic law. It reminded me of the experience. I'm not saying I had PTSD, but it was kind of like that. And I just couldn't do those kind of cases. I really couldn't. I did many of them, but I just said I can't do it anymore.
When you say you did do it, when you look back now, how would you rate your performance in those cases? Because obviously you put yourself in a situation that would be very difficult. Do you feel like you did a good job in those cases?
Yeah, I actually did. I think as a public defender, I was pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't short shrift any of the cases because of my brother's experience. I gave them, all I had, and I did a good job.
Other aspect of, and I'm trying to pull it back from the book when I read it, is I'm not sure if it was the first time or the second time, but you were surprised it was only like a 10-day hold for your brother, and then he was automatically going to be released. Am I right about that again?
Yes.
And is that, again, that sounded like such a surprise for you and for the family. Does that kind of stuff still happen today?
Or? Sure, it can happen. This was an agreement where he would go in on a voluntary in lieu of the actual commitment. And so we, our family agreed to that with Lee's public defender. And again, we didn't really have a prosecutor on it to work our side on that deal. And that he got out and he was then not supervised. And it resulted then in him getting a shotgun and really endangering the public. But I felt that that was something that certainly could have been avoided. But it can happen today, but usually prosecutors are a lot more sophisticated about this thing, and they have a case, they're going to get the commitment if the person really is dangerous so that they have that supervision. Mm-hmm. The ones that I've contacted in Madison or I knew very well just didn't agree to these kinds of things.
Right.
Because they knew it was dangerous for the public.
We got to take a quick break, but we're going to come back. I want to talk about where we do stand today for people that maybe in a situation dealing with this illness and maybe what you've learned, obviously, and also what you know about the system today, maybe some things to think about or look for, and maybe talk a little bit as well about what other changes you would like to see, because obviously being involved in it, as you said, both as a family mm-hmm. member and also somebody that's been worked within the judicial system as well. So we're going to come back, talk some more with Kenneth Farmer, again, author of Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. And again, we'll talk to Ken about how you can get that book as well before we wrap things up. Because as I said before, and I'm not just saying it, I really enjoyed reading that book. I took the weekend before Ken came on the first time around to read that book. And I thought, oh, it's going to be hard to do this, to get through the entire book. But it really was something I enjoyed reading, a page turner. And I would really encourage you to check it out yourself. So we'll talk about that and more with Kenneth Farmer coming up as we continue. The time is 9:30. I'm Chad Holmes here on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230 WXCO. And welcome back. Chad Holmes with you here on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230, online at bowfallsradio.com. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Again, we are talking to Kenneth Farmer. He's an author from Stevens Point, also an attorney. He wrote a terrific memoir, Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. We'd had Ken on previously talking about the book and the stories within the book. And today we're trying to talk a little bit more about the illness, talk about the law, and something that you know, we're talking in the break. Let's talk about schizophrenia and the signs. And you said that, hey, there's some different signs. And what are the signs? Number one, I think, intellectually and educationally, and maybe what you saw and how you, you know, in terms of information you found out, how you use it in terms of what you lived in your life.
Well, the signs in childhood, there can be childhood schizophrenia, but only in like a 2% of the cases. More often, they are just precursors, predictors, or signs. And some of them include depression. Some of them include behavioral problems in school. Some of them, and these things my brother had.
I was going to say real fast, you said only 2% have a childhood. Do you think your brother was one of the 2%?
I am always confused about that. He did, like at 12 years old, he wanted to run away home from home to get tropical fish and make $1 million. That sounded like schizophrenia to me.
Right.
But he wasn't really, that was just, he didn't have the rest of the, classic delusional stuff all the time, or, you know, so I don't know if he did, but I do know he had the precursors.
Right.
He was depressed at times. He was withdrawn. He did have some suspiciousness towards other people, especially my mother. He did have problems with self-care, especially when he was a teenager. Now, that's a clear indicator where their ability to keep their appearance up suddenly changes. Marked changes in energy, changes in their emotional relationships with friends. My brother started having no friends.
Right.
And bizarre thinking. You know, like we've just described, confused or bizarre thinking. So those are some of the precursors. What's interesting about that is the predictors of outcome. Is there going to be a good outcome or a bad outcome once a person becomes schizophrenic?
Right.
My brother had all the symptoms of a bad outcome. If you have problems in childhood like that, that's a bad outcome predictor. If you were normal, quote normal, in childhood, it's a good one. Males have a tougher time with it than females, as far as being able to survive it.
Real quickly about that, in terms of the number of percentages of schizophrenics, how many are male, how many are female? Do you have any idea on that?
I don't know the number on
it. Does
that
seem like, we hear more about the male aspect of it, and that's I really hadn't thought about.
Well, I don't know the statistical breakdown, but you have a better shot if you're a female.
Sure.
If there's no family history of schizophrenia, you have a better shot. Mm. But we had a family history. Mm. If you are the younger it starts, the worse your chances. Mm. There was also just their initial response to treatment. If they reject it, they're less likely to be successful. There are some that completely accept it and know they have a problem. See, my brother didn't.
Right. Did he ever have a point where he had acceptance of the treatment, or did he?
Yes.
Because I remember talking about it. It seemed as though there were moments, and especially...
He did. Well, I don't know if I mentioned this in the last program. I know that he was in a group home in Wausau here, the Sullivan House. And I know that after he died, the group home director said that he had an acceptance of it. He was actually there on a voluntary basis for years. So that shows acceptance of it. He didn't have to be committed anymore. He knew he was sick.
When you talk about these signs and even precursors for kids, it's got to be difficult for the adults, when we talk about, I guess we'll transfer into maybe treatments, to say, it would be scary in a sense. I would almost think that adults would look for reasons not to think that they have it, because it's such a...
Absolutely.
So you see these signs and maybe even the precursors. What are the steps
The problem is it's pretty vague. Yeah, as to whether it is. It's very clear.
And it's almost as though you want to be positive that, they don't have
it. It is. Ambiguous.
Yeah.
And so I would say that, getting the person help right away, no matter, don't jump to the conclusion that it's that, but getting the person early intervention is actually healthy. And somehow or another, that has to be addressed. But it doesn't have to be put like the person is crazy or, you can't put it that way. You have to say, you're having problems with this or that, and maybe we should go and seek help for this. And so not make it so the person is having a label put on them. Was it effective?
It's been more than 50 years since you lived through this. How do we discuss it differently now than we did back then? Do you find that people are more open about discussing it, about finding treatments, about trying to take steps forward? Because I think that, different generations are more open in some ways than maybe other generations.
Well, I think we've come a long way in terms of the issue of stigma. Let me give an example. When I did these kind of cases as a public defender, we would always ask in jury selection, how many people here have had an experience of mental illness, they themselves or within their family? Because, as a public defender, perhaps those people would be against the, I didn't know what their attitudes would be, and I didn't want a biased person on my jury, neither did the prosecutor. So we'd always ask it, and no one ever raised their hands. And now everyone raises their hands nearly in the jury pool. And so that shows you where we've come in terms of attitude and openness about this kind of problem.
Treatment. How far have we come in terms of treatments? Because obviously, it was 1970s when you were first taking the steps. As you said, you saw signs even before then. Treatments, where do we stand with that?
Treatment has improved a lot. They've advanced the use of medication quite a bit. And it used to be, in my brother's day, the side effects were very, very heavy. And there were, and there still are side effects, but the medication is much better. And, you know, I mean, the problem when you have those kind of side effects, it discourages people from wanting to get treatment. And now we don't have as much of a problem. We've had, we have more long-term injectable drugs, which, you know, they could, you know, which avoids the revolving door, if you would, of hospitalization, because they're not taking it every day. Mm-hmm. They're taking it every 2 weeks or month or even 6 weeks. And that's advanced a lot on the medical end. Mm-hmm. So there definitely have been, and I think the law has improved too. But I don't know that we're ready to just say, okay, we don't have to make any further improvements.
Right. We'll talk more about the law, where it stands, and maybe the improvements in just a few minutes. But something else I wanted to touch on with you, because you mentioned it to me as well, about the family dynamics. About, mm-hmm. you know, how it affects the people around the schizophrenic and how it's affected, you know, and you said, you know, you were looking at some of these signs and you saw them in yourself. I mean, it's like, and the people around the person with the illness, and there's so many commonalities within those dynamics, aren't there?
Oh, well, you know, what was interesting, when I wrote my book, a third of my book is about those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I would, you know, I mean, I had problems. For example, I felt like I was being shortchanged, you know, relative to my brother. My parents spent more money on him, more time on him, because he had a problem and I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was being shortchanged, you know, and I was angry towards my parents and towards my brother.
And a great story in the book for folks to, I mean, really, I thought it was like, it's like, it's like you, it felt like you weren't getting rewarded for doing the right things and doing well in school, mm-hmm. and doing all this other stuff. And there was that moment where the anger just really did come shooting out.
Oh, it did. And I remember yelling at my parents about it and being very upset about it. And I had problems too. Mm-hmm. I was starting to use pot too much, not going to class, doing things. I was having struggles. And yet it was all about my brother and his problems. Mm-hmm. And so I had disagreements with my parents over that. But the other thing, which was very interesting in the dynamic, was I did not want to fail, because my brother was sick. He was my only sibling. Mm-hmm. I was sort of the family hero. I was going to get to law school. No matter what, I was going to go. No matter what, I was going to get through. I, you know, made it so that I would never make a mistake. And that was stressful, extremely stressful, because it just felt like I carried so much on my shoulders. And, you know, I had to be an Eagle Scout. I had to be these things and do well at everything. Now, there's two sides to that. Okay, that motivated me to do well, which is a good thing.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it placed a lot of stress on me.
Also, you know, again, going back to, you know, 1960s and 1970s, when you were growing up within this dynamic, to now, are there more ways for folks who are family members or siblings to be able to get help? Because they need help as well. And that's one of the things where it's not just the person with the ultimate illness of schizophrenia that needs that help. The people around them, as you said, so much weight on the shoulders within families and within dynamics of families. Do you see that there's more opportunity for discussion and help in that way?
I think there is. I mean, like when I was dealing with this with my brother, nobody even called me back.
Right.
You know, I said, hey, I need to talk to you about my family and what it was like. It's not just schizophrenia. There's all these other problems that exist in my family, and never called me back. That would not happen now. The other thing is there have been programs developed for the families. The Alliance for the Mentally Ill is an example of that. There are chapters, probably 15 chapters just in this state. There's a statewide conference in every state in the country that deal with these kinds of issues that are for families. So, there is a lot more opportunity for support. And I think also, just what we talked about earlier, it's like the stigma isn't quite as bad. You know, there's a lot of publicity about mental illness on TV and radio and everything. And I think that families aren't as embarrassed about it. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned to you previously, that's a real symptom, you know. I didn't want to walk on the same straight side of the street as my brother. I didn't want to be seen with him.
Didn't invite him to your law school graduation.
He wasn't to any of my graduations or when I got married ultimately, you know. And in talking about marriage, I really do think I didn't get married till I was in my 40s because I just couldn't get over the concept that, well, what if I had children who were schizophrenic? Do I want to go through that again myself?
Right.
And that is something that probably people still have to deal with, but people need to understand it's not entirely genetic.
And real quickly, before we have to take one more quick break, about the aspect of embarrassment, there's another story about, you know, you had a girlfriend that basically was, I think, a little confused because you wouldn't really talk about your family. I was going to ask you, over the years, were you able to come to terms with those feelings?
Mostly. I was able to talk about my family more. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I included my brother. Because, okay, you have a wedding, for example. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with all that. You can't be your brother's keeper during the course of a wedding. I mean, these are practical problems. And so I can't say that I've ever completely overcome those problems, but I got better. You mentioned the incident about a girlfriend. Well, you know, that was like, there's a lot in the book about camping out. In other words, the perception was I wasn't a person that liked commitment then. See, because, well, normally a person would introduce a girlfriend to their family eventually, and the fact that they're not doing it shows they're not committed to them, you know? And so this disadvantaged me in my relationships with women. It really did.
The old red flag, right?
he's ready to get out, you know? And so I think I did do a lot better in that department over time, but some things I still had problems with.
We got to take one more quick break and then come back with a few more minutes with Ken Farmer, again, the author of Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. More to come here on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 12. And welcome back. Chad Holmes Show on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230. Online at bullfallsradio.com. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. A few more minutes with author Ken Farmer. Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. Stevens Point resident and as well. Raised in a rig. Again, in the book, some great stories of when he moved to Stevens Point during the 60s and following the Packers and all the stories behind that and sneaking into school gyms. I mean, a lot of good stories in there. So beyond the topic of, I mean, just, you know, if anybody lived and grew up around here, I think there's a lot of things that would connect with folks. Again, we'll tell you how to get the book in just a few minutes. But before we get done, want to get back to the laws. Again, we talked about Kenneth Farmer, a lawyer, has dealt with these issues, both in his personal life and his professional life as well. Where do we, in terms of where we stand and where we need to go, your thoughts? Because obviously, as you said, we've made strides forward. Where are we today? Do you feel, I don't know if the word comfortable is the right word, about where we are in terms of treating both the individuals involved with the illness and the families around them and the community at large, and areas that we can take steps forward with?
Well, one of the things that's developed over time is reducing the number of people that are in the hospital. That has been reduced considerably over time. Now the length of time that people stay in the hospital is like 7 or 10 days, you know, if at all, before they get out. So that's been a good thing, and that's where it stands now. We need to continue to do that. There is a program called the Community Support Program that exists throughout Wisconsin. It's paid for by the 5142 board in each of the county if they choose to have it. And what they do is they send people out to their homes to interview and talk to the mentally ill and see if they've decompensated, see if they're taking their medication, and to actually administer the medication on site. They're qualified to do that and to be able to report back to the authorities if they're off the wagon, you know, off gone off their meds and are having symptoms. So that's been a good program, and that's where it stands now. We do need to have other things, though, that help with the revolving door still, more of that kind of thing, so the people aren't just going in and out of the mental hospital. We do need to have, and this is sad, one of the most successful forms of treatment for my brother was being in a group home. That was the kind of care he needed. One, he had friends. Mm-hmm. He wasn't alone like before. And two, there was more structure to his treatment. And that was very successful for him. Well, now there's only 11 of them in the entire state of Wisconsin. I think that we need to, in Wisconsin, I know the idea is to maintain this three signature requirement for a commitment petition. I think there should only be one responsible adult or family member or somebody, they could list them. That's what they do in most other states. Why do you need three? If that problem didn't exist, we would have gotten my brother committed and the public would not have been as endangered back right. in the day. And that still exists. I think they need to broaden the criteria of dangerousness to self or others to, there other states don't use this recent overt act requirement. And I think that that's a little heavy-handed. I think it could also be like something like under the totality of the circumstances, the person is dangerous
right.
to other people. There doesn't have to be that specificity. And so those are improvements that I think that can be made. But Wisconsin actually does pretty well in terms of its mental health system. The Treatment Advocacy Center has given it an A-. Minnesota gets an A+. But Kentucky gets a C+. Maryland gets an F. So, you know, it just depends on the state. But we do actually pretty well in terms of our treatment of the mentally ill relative to other states.
To wrap it up, because we only have about a minute and a half. Number one, before we ask, I have a short final question. How can people get the book? What's the best way to get the book? Because I think it's definitely worth a read.
Well, you can just get on my website. It's Ken Farmer Writes, WRITES.com. And I'll be happy to send you the book. If you have, it's better if you have PayPal, because that's the way you have to pay.
Right.
And you can get a PayPal account if you want to. And that enables me to then, you know, they then notify me, and then I have your address, I send you the book, and then you have it. Now, the other way of doing it is to get on Amazon or to go through my publisher, which is Orange Hat Publishing out of Milwaukee. You can purchase it through them, too.
Terrific. And we got 40 seconds. I asked you this at the end, I think the last time around. Are you happy that you went through this entire process? Writing this book?
Yeah, I think it's helped me process this a little better. It's made, people have come up to me and given me a lot more support than what I had. A lot of it's my own fault because I didn't tell them.
Right.
I kept it to myself. So that's been good. I'm hoping that continues. There are parts of me that writing a memoir causes you to talk about all your regrets in life, too.
Right.
And not just to do with this subject. You know, it gets you in that frame of mind.
Ken Farmer, thanks again. Really fun to have you back on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. CBS News.